This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Samantha Donovan. This Monday, can Australia meet its emissions reduction targets without relying on carryover carbon credits? And warnings of an imminent volcanic eruption similar to New Zealand's White Island, but this one could be bigger and even more dangerous.
Well, the recent eruption at White Island was minor in scale compared with what Taal has been known to do historically. And Taal is in a highly populated place, and that's why the potential societal hazard demands some attention from us.
First today, conservationists are warning Australia's wildlife has been decimated by the bushfires this summer. Mapping is now underway to find out just how badly our native animals and their habitats have been hit. And today, the federal government's announced an initial $50 million from its Bushfire Recovery Fund will go towards helping wildlife and land management. With more, I'm joined by political reporter Alexandra Beach. Alex, firstly, can you give us some more details of this announcement from the Environment Minister today?
Yes, Sam. So the $50 million you mentioned is going towards an initial response to what's expected to be quite extensive bushfire damage to native plants and animals. That money is going to be coming out of the $2 billion bushfire response fund that the government had already announced. And the Environment Minister, Susan Lee, has stressed it is an initial commitment. So there could be further funding on the way as the extent of the damage starts to become clearer. Now, as you mentioned, conservationists are already saying that native animals have been decimated over the past few months, that their habitat and the plants they rely on have been badly burnt out. So they're already warning that really more money is going to be needed here as this progresses. But for the meantime, half the money announced today is going to be going towards supporting wildlife rescues, zoos, conservation volunteers and the like with the work that they do. The other half is going towards an emergency intervention fund. Basically, the money in that will be spent on things like weed control or baiting feral cats, trying to help those surviving populations to recover. And overall, this is the latest in a series of announcements that we've had from the federal government about how the money from that broader bushfire fund is going to be used. For example, there was $76 million yesterday towards mental health and trauma services, and we are expecting there to be more announcements coming out over the next few days.
And at that announcement this morning, the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, has been fielding questions on the government's broader response to climate change. What did he have to say?
Well, he has very much stuck to the lines that the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was using yesterday in his interview on Insiders, really. That is, he's acknowledged that there are going to be lessons learnt out of these fires and that Cabinet will consider calling a Royal Commission, the plan being that that inquiry would look in part at the role that climate change has played here. But like the Prime Minister yesterday, Josh Frydenberg is stressing that a Royal Commission would be more focused on things like the role of the federal government in the bushfire response, how the Defence Force is deployed for national disasters, that sort of thing. And he's also sticking to his guns on emissions targets, saying that Australia will meet and beat its current targets. So no changes there at this stage either. Here's a little of what he had to say.
We believe you can reduce emissions, and we are reducing emissions, without compromising jobs, without new taxes. That's where our focus is at. We are seeing a smaller carbon footprint across the economy. At the same time, our population's been growing and our economy's been growing. But we absolutely need to manage this transition in a very sensible way. And the Prime Minister yesterday used the term balance.
The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. And Alex, the government's also taken a hit in the latest news poll. Has there been much reaction to that this morning?
Yes, so today's news poll has the coalition falling behind Labor on a two-party preferred basis for the first time since the election, 49-51. Now, keeping in mind that polls have been treated with a healthy degree of scepticism since they predicted Labor was going to win the federal election last year, and we are obviously several years away from the poll that really matters, the next election, this has still provoked questions to government MPs today, in particular, whether they think that this hit reflects perhaps a bit of a slap down by the community over the way the government's handled these bushfires. And Josh Frydenberg was asked about that this morning. Here's what he had to say.
Well, we've heard the message loud and clear from the Australian people. They want to see the federal government adopt a very direct response to these natural and national disasters. And that's what we're doing.
The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, and before him, our political reporter, Alexandra Beach. Well, over the weekend, the Prime Minister signalled the federal government may be prepared to rethink its commitment to using Kyoto carryover credits to ensure Australia meets its 2030 target under the Paris Agreement. He's still ruling out a carbon tax, increasing electricity prices, or writing off high-emission industries, though. John Connor is the CEO of the Carbon Market Institute, a peak industry body for businesses working on the transition to net zero emissions. He's told me he's confident Australia can meet its 2030 target without using the Kyoto carryover credits.
But it may need to tighten some of its policy parameters, and I'm talking about existing policy here. The government has options. They are reviewing what they call the safeguard mechanism, which is a compliance mechanism for some of our bigger emitters. They are reviewing a whole other range of technology strategies. We saw a hydrogen strategy come out at the end of last year. There's an electric vehicle strategy to come out. The government's announced, the Minister Taylor told COAG about a technology investment roadmap. And amongst all of that is also a commitment to develop a mid-century plan, and which is one in which many countries are using to have a net zero emissions strategy. And all of that can be bundled in to a evolution of policy that can back can work without using Kyoto carryovers.
Yes, the Prime Minister often refers to Australia's high uptake of renewable energy, but is that enough to make the difference, though, alone?
No, not in the view of many. The big problem is that there was a 2020 target. There's now question marks about what might drive a renewable energy investment moving forward. There's considerable debate. I know the Clean Energy Council is saying already that investment is stalling. So there is a big questions about the future of areas in particular, not only in renewable energy, but in these other key areas across the economy.
What are businesses you work with saying about the proposed use of the Kyoto carryover credits? Are they in favour?
Well, we did our annual survey of business attitudes just at the end of last year, and some 76% of business respondents said Australia shouldn't be using the Kyoto carryover. We saw 83% of those saying that we should have a net zero target by 2050, and almost universal, 96% said that Australia needs to have stronger policies. Otherwise, the more we delay, we're going to have a more abrupt and forceful policies, which could be even more damaging economically. So business people out there know that we need to have some tightening of our policies. And I actually happen to think that there's some opportunities there for the government in 2020 to evolve their policy mix drive some of these changes.
Did any of the big emitters take part in that survey?
Yes, indeed. We had over a third of respondents were from big emitters. So this is an annual survey we do across industry, and some 80% of those were in CEOs, senior management, or at the boardroom level.
The Prime Minister has flagged perhaps not having to use the credits. What chance do you think he's got of getting his colleagues in the government to back him on that?
Well, I think there's every chance, but I do think we need to use this year to see some significant evolution of the government's policies and use the reviews and strategy preparation commitments they've got to get us there. This is about planning for a transition. We can do this, but we do need some clearer guidance, and we certainly need some development in areas where government policy is uncertain, and that not only includes renewable energy, electric vehicles, hydrogen they're stepping up on. There's areas in terms of carbon capture and storage. There are significant opportunities for land-based management, so as part of the discussion around the bushfire recovery, There's been already some very good stories about farmers who have been using carbon farming through the government's Emissions Reduction Fund to better manage their land. And so that's part of the mix that, needs to be discussed. And all of this is that recognising that the pressure internationally is continuing to grow, and really the spotlight has been put on Australia. We can move from a poster child of climate inaction to one that's probably leading the climate effort, and which is so clearly now in our national interest.
John Connor, the CEO of the Carbon Market Institute. Parts of the country are still struggling with severe water shortages. Stanthorpe, a town in Queensland's Southern Downs, has become the latest to move to full-time water carting. And as Meghna Bali reports, the flow into Sydney's biggest dam is plunging.
Around 40 truckloads of water will be transported to Queensland's Granite Belt today to begin the largest water carting project by a local government. 1.3 million litres of water will be trucked into Stanthorpe from the Connolly Dam and will cost $800,000 a month, fully funded by the Queensland government. It's welcome relief. Local Mayor Tracy Dobie says the drought's taken a significant toll on her community.
There's no doubt that this drought and the water shortage has affected the mental well-being of everybody in our region. I know myself how hard it is to wake up every morning. I live on a rural property. I look out the window and there's these beautiful blue skies, but of course the trees are dying, the grounds turn grey, there's nothing green anywhere except for the trees that are still alive. It's very disheartening. It's very disheartening to see our livestock disappear as they all have to be sold off. It's just disappointing not to see crops in the ground, and that is affecting everyone in our region.
The water shortage isn't just impacting the regions. Dams in the country's most populous cities are also at risk. Figures from Water New South Wales reveal since the drought hit Sydney almost 3 years ago, 281 billion litres have flowed into Warragamba Dam. That's less than half the previous drought of record during 1939 to 41, when the dam received 628 billion litres. Adrian Langdon, Executive Manager for Water Systems Operations at Water New South Wales, says the water reservoir is sitting at around 40% capacity.
Since then, we've been on a very dramatic drop, downward curve in terms of what inflows we've been receiving. So being now in the low 40s, we are starting to get into some foreseeable critical conditions going forward if we don't see a change in weather patterns.
And with longer and harsher droughts predicted, Water New South Wales is scoping out different drought management measures.
We just need to be able to build greater levels of resilience into our water supplies across our communities, not just in Sydney, but also in our regional communities, to ensure that we are able to manage future droughts, because when this drought does break, we do know that there will be another one. And that's really what we've got to be planning for now.
The Bureau of Meteorology's latest climate outlook shows roughly equal chances of being wetter or drier than average for most of Australia over the next 3 months. But it predicts several months of above average rainfall will be needed for most areas to recover.
Meghna Bali reporting. Economists are warning the next few months will be critical for the survival of some small towns and small businesses across the country. Areas still threatened by the bushfires are being described as ghost towns, and their local traders are struggling to stay afloat. A surge in spending in November, largely due to the Black Friday sales event, is providing some hope for retailers. But economists are warning January and February sales could be well down again. Here's business reporter David Taylor.
The southern New South Wales town of Braidwood, smack bang in between Canberra and Batemans Bay, has been caught between a rock and a hard place.
And they've been hit hard.
Peter Strong is the CEO of the Small Business Council of Australia.
This time of year, that's when it makes a lot of money. All the Canberra people drive through there, and at the moment it's a ghost town. So they're being impacted just as badly as other businesses have been as well.
The threat of bushfires are adding to a growing list of reasons shoppers are choosing to tighten their purse strings, including low wage growth. To lure shoppers through their doors, retailers are using highly publicised events like Black Friday to push through heavy discounts. And this year, it worked a charm. BIS Oxford Economics Chief Economist Sarah Hunter concedes she too did her Christmas shopping in November.
Yeah, I'm definitely part of that boost to those November figures as an individual.
And why did you choose to do your shopping then?
Because we had some travel plans, so we actually headed out to my family, which is back in the UK, for Christmas, so needed to get a bit ahead of things just to get organised.
Like many analysts, though, she fears the next few months could bring quite a bit of pain for businesses across the country. That's because as retailers gradually raise their prices again to maintain their margins, consumers less confident about the future will likely tighten their purse strings again.
And this is despite the fact that with the cash rate cuts that we've already had and with the increase in the low and middle income tax offsets as well that came through the second half of last year. And it's that caution which does seem to be really weighing on retailers in particular at the moment.
Amid the gloom, the Small Business Council's Peter Strong has told The World Today many businesses are helping each other out and their customers by turning off their automated billing systems, offering anyone that owes them money a bit of breathing space.
You know, you don't want to be getting those things when you're in the middle of a crisis. So big cash flow issues. And cash flow, when you have a cash flow issue, managing it and getting over it can take you 12 months or 2 years. It just depends.
It's hard enough to work out what to put on the shelves in order to sell the best of times, let alone not really being able to know for sure when people are going to be coming back in a normal kind of way. So how do businesses restock? A bit of a gamble, isn't it? How do they know when to start up again?
Well, that's a very good question. First of all, you've got industry associations, and they've been very heavily involved in this. The Master Grocers Association, the hairdressers, the bookkeepers, all these people, they go out to their members and they say, this is what you need to do. They've got their own helplines, and businesses talk to each other. I mean, that's one of the great things about main streets and high streets is they come together like people do in the suburbs when there's a crisis. They talk to each other, they support each other, they give each other information, and they give each other goods that they need. But this issue around the employee is really important because they're going to obviously be stood down. There won't be any work. The fear we have is that they'll pack up and leave town. So we're talking to the government about many, many things. We're certainly talking about what do we do here with this situation where if you don't have workers, you can't open up. But if you do open up, then you'll be paying them and maybe not making an income.
The Reserve Bank is also widely tipped to continue cutting interest rates in a bid to kickstart the economy when it reconvenes after the Christmas break.
David Taylor reporting. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Overseas now, and in Iran, protests are becoming more violent after the government's admission it was responsible for shooting down a Ukrainian Airlines flight last week. The protesters say the mistake, which led to the death of all 176 passengers, is unforgivable. In Canada, the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has addressed a memorial service for students killed in the crash and vowed to pursue justice. Isabel Bro prepared this report.
They've been warned, but these Iranians are risking prosecution or worse for taking to the streets to denounce their government. The unrest is in its second day in response to Iran's admission that it accidentally shot down the Ukrainian International Airlines flight that crashed over the capital Tehran last week, killing 176 people, many of them Iranian. In Tehran, university students are filmed purposely avoiding stepping on an American flag painted on the ground. In some protests, Iranians chant, "They are lying that our enemy is America. Our enemy is right here." 57 of the 176 who died in the crash were Canadian citizens, most of Iranian descent. They've been remembered in two memorial services in Canada today. At one memorial in Toronto, Masoud Nikmam paid tribute to his brother, Fahad Nikmam.
My family is devastated. They've lost the most supporting person they've ever had. We all will have a hole in our hearts forever.
And almost 2,000 people have gathered for a second memorial in Edmonton, where 13 of the victims had ties to the University of Alberta. Among the mourners, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
I am so deeply sorry for your loss. This tragedy should never have occurred, and I want to assure you that you have my full support. during this extraordinarily difficult time. But I also want you to know how grateful we are for you who are still with us.
He's promised the friends and families of those killed that they will see justice.
You give us purpose to pursue justice and accountability for you. We will continue to work with our partners to ensure that a full, transparent investigation is conducted. I want to assure all families and all Canadians, we will not rest until there are answers.
Iran says the United States is to blame for killing its most powerful general, Qasem Soleimani, starting a chain of events that led to the accidental downing of the Ukrainian Airlines flight. With tensions between the US and Iran on the rise, Australia is on its way to the region. 200 soldiers on board HMAS Toowoomba set sail for the Strait of Hormuz today in a mission to help protect oil supplies. The deployment was announced last year and is still supported by the federal government and Shadow Defence Minister Richard Marles.
We're all concerned about what has played out in Iran and in that part of the world over the last few weeks. But the mission that HMAS Toowoomba is going to be participating in is a very important one. It goes directly to Australia's national interest and we remain supportive of it.
HMAS Toowoomba is scheduled to arrive in the Middle East within a fortnight.
Isabel Rowe reporting. A huge release of steam and ash from the Taal volcano south of the Philippines' capital, Manila, is leading authorities to warn 8,000 people to leave the area. The volcano has emitted a plume of grey ash that shot a kilometre into the sky and that was accompanied by rumbling sounds and tremors. Three earthquakes were also recorded and ash from the volcano has been landing in the capital. Julia Andre prepared this report.
With plumes of ash, amid flickering volcanic lightning, one of the Philippines' most active volcanoes, Taal, awakened on Sunday. The volcano is one of the smallest in the world, but yesterday it ramped up the action. Residents watched on as a column of rock and steam up to 15 kilometres high spewed out, choking the skies in darkness.
When the volcano emitted steam, we ran away up here. The road was crowded. Thick ash and pebbles were falling.
Thousands of residents have been ordered to leave their homes already. This man says he had to evacuate and leave all his belongings. And by early evening, authorities had ratcheted up the warning level three times, saying a hazardous explosive eruption and volcanic tsunami were possible. Professor Richard Arculus is a volcanologist at the Australian National University and says thousands of tourists visit the area near the volcano.
There are a number of villages surrounding the lake. It's a kind of popular place to visit, a nice tourist attraction. And I've been to Taal and gone out on the lake. There are plenty of people making a living out of tourism to it. So those people are under direct threat.
He believes this latest eruption could be the result of volcanic magma coming into contact with fresh water in an adjoining lake.
Well, Taal is sat in a freshwater lake. There's no question that fresh water is involved in the, in some ways, in the eruption. They're called phreatomagmatic. Phreato means water. Magmatic as magma. So interactions of magma and water are very potentially explosive and dangerous. And in the event of seawater getting into the system, it creates another bunch of what I would call interesting phenomena. So Taal shares the interaction of seawater, groundwater and magma with White Island.
With thousands of homes already cleared and schools closed, the Philippines waits to see if this volcano is about to show its full power. And that could prove more catastrophic and deadly than the eruption seen on New Zealand's White Island late last year.
Well, the recent eruption at White Island was minor in scale compared with what Taal has been known to do historically. So columns of ash and dust going up into the stratosphere, 10, 12 kilometres high, and also base surges, which are when explosion reaches the Earth's surface, in addition to transferring a lot of energy and materials up into the sky, there's also a circumferential blast of gas, dust, blocks hugging the surface of the Earth. And in the case of Taal, that's initially the lake in which the main vent sits.
That report from Julia Andre. And that's The World Today for this Monday. I'm Samantha Donovan. Have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.